The next case is 07-113, Robert E. Schlegel, Executor versus Tom Gindelsberger. Mr. Rosenfeld.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal if I may. For purposes of the record, I would like to say initially that neither appellants nor their counsel have now or have ever had any contact whatsoever with the state of Louisiana. I thought I would make that clear. 25 years ago, when this court decided Simon versus Zipperstein, it did so on the basis essentially of the dissent in the Scheller case, which was authored by Chief Justice Celebrezze. In that case, and in that dissent, Justice Celebrezze set forth the argument that in order for an attorney to be sued by the beneficiary or potential beneficiary of an estate, that claimant, that plaintiff, would have to have privity with that attorney. Today, the court has the opportunity to revisit, as time in the last 25 years have changed substantially. In the last 25 years, Ohio's law has now become the distinct minority in the United States. Fewer than 9 states today require privity to exist in order for the potential beneficiary of an estate to sue a malpracticing attorney.
What you're asking essentially, I think, Mr. Rosenfeld, is that we overrule the earlier court decision in Simon versus Zipperstein and make a decision in line with what a number of other states have done.
Essentially, Your Honor, that's correct.
Would we then have to follow our Gallatus analysis if we were going to overrule a precedent based on what we have done in Scott Ponser? And should that be the subject of your argument?
I think that you would have to apply the Gallatus analysis, and I think that under Gallatus, this case, Simon versus Zipperstein, and the case, the modification to that we now argue, would qualify. It's my understanding under Gallatus, you first must show that there has been a change of some nature or that the case initially was decided incorrectly. There is strong sentiment that the initial case, Simon, was not correctly decided. However, given that it was, the times have changed substantially. We now look to professionals in this state and in virtually every state and virtually every other class of professional as being responsible for the damage that they foreseeably do to the persons that they are intended to benefit by their employment. And I think that, Your Honor, is a distinct difference between what we request and the position that you stated. We do not advocate.
I'm not stating a position. I'm just trying to follow the argument you're making. And since we have an established case, would seem to me that your burden would be, under Gallatus, to show that it was wrongly decided, it defies practical workability, and there would be no harm as a result of our overruling that, creating
correct.
A hardship for those that would have been relying on it.
Well, under Gallatus, again, it is not only
unless you're asking us to modify Gallatus. I mean, I guess I'm exploring with you. What is your position here?
My position is that we meet Gallatus. My position is that things have been, that circumstances and situations have societally and legally changed materially since.
Why does our rule requiring privity of contract defy practical workability for the lawsuit to be filed against an attorney?
Given that we look for today full accountability to the extent that it is probable for our professionals towards those who foreseeably can be injured as a result of their negligence, the rule in Simon creates an impractical situation for the very reason that those attorneys who in the course of an estate planning practice commit malpractice are not responsible. So if we're going to say that the professional should be responsible to those who are foreseeably injured, then you can't do it with Simon versus Zipperstein.
Eliminating the privity requirement for suit against an attorney, I mean, theoretically, then if an attorney would prepare a contract for a client and satisfy the client, but perhaps adversely affect others, would they be in a position to file a suit against that attorney?
Not under the change that we request, Your Honor. Remember that we are not advocating the complete abrogation and the overruling Simon versus Zipperstein per se.
That's what I'm trying to have you articulate
for
us. What is it you want?
We're asking for a modification only under the circumstances where the attorney is employed to do something to directly benefit a known class or group of people, and the failure of the attorney to do that is foreseeably will produce damage and injury to those people. We're not asking for a complete abrogation. The argument
Counsel, what about the conflict of interest that you're setting up that is inherent in what you're proposing here? If a individual requests of an attorney to do something and it's between the attorney and the client, how is the attorney to determine the impact on, say, the natural heirs of that individual?
In the situation that we are advocating, and in the cases that presented in the Schlegel case that is before you, the attorney knew what his client wanted to do. Margaret Schlegel wanted to benefit her three children. They were identified as such, and the interests that she wished to protect were identified as such. That is not the situation where, for example, an estate planning client goes to the lawyer and says, "Mr. Jones, I wish to disinherit my son, Sam." In that case, the lawyer would do exactly what he has been told to do. He does so without any conflict because there is no conflict between the desire of the testator in that case and the lawyer's obligation to that testator. However, here, the client went to the lawyer and said, "I wish to benefit my three children in equipoise. Please do that for me."
But the client also said, "I want to retain a life interest, and I want to retain the water rights, and I want to retain the mineral rights," and that triggers the inclusion for tax purposes of the estate. So she can't have it both ways.
That's right. She cannot have it both ways, and it was the attorney's obligation to tell her that. It was the attorney's obligation to know the law and to say to Mrs. Schlegel, "Mrs. Schlegel, I'm happy to do this for you. However, you must understand that that will destroy your estate plan." If she then said, "Okay, that's what I want to do," and under our rules, this would have had to have been documented now by the attorney when he confirms his assignment to his client.
Well, and I understand what you're saying in this particular case, but we're not necessarily concerned with just this particular case. So I'm looking at the long term and the big picture here, and it seems to me what you're advocating is that every time an individual decides to do some estate planning, there better be the entire family at the table to determine who's going to object and who's going to get the shorter end of the stick potentially. And it just seems to me that it sets up, it breaches an attorney-client relationship and in favor of satisfying a non-existent relationship or duty that at that time, as I said, is non-existent. The mother here didn't owe the children anything, did she?
She owed the children nothing whatsoever.
So she didn't breach a duty to them. They have no expectation.
Nor would they be entitled to. However, once she expressed to her attorney her desire to benefit those children specifically, the attorney then bears the obligation to, in a workmanlike fashion, execute her desire. The chimera, if you will, of this disenchanted child of the heir who was not left anything is no more than a ghostly presence. It doesn't happen when the attorney who is executing his assignment knows the law and advises the potential testator or testatrix of the effect of what that person is doing. We don't say that the attorney has to watch out for the child, and we don't say that that child or anyone else, any other class of people, have the right to demand damages from the attorney unless the attorney was able to foresee damage to a known person or known group of people, class of people, which would flow from his failure.
Mr. Rosenfeld, it sounds like you're really mixing up the tort and contract principles here. We have a professional contract which the attorney enters into with the client, and the duty that the attorney has under those circumstances is to the client, as Justice O'Connor was saying. That is the situation, and there may be other people out there that will be affected by what the attorney does for a particular client.
That's correct, and to the extent that those people are affected, too bad. However, in this particular instance, the notion of the melding, if it were, of tort, a negligence-based system, and contract is necessary. All of the states, or virtually all of the states who have considered this, have said, yes, that's right. This is neither pure contract law, nor is it pure tort law. However, the remedy is what we're looking for, and to create an artificial barrier by creation of privity in a circumstance where the lawyer gets a free pass, as it were, no one is able to correct this the errant lawyer's mistake.
Isn't it possible to draw the lines more simply in that if this attorney had given full disclosure to his client of all the ramifications of what she wanted to do, then his client could have made an informed choice and the beneficiaries take what happens. In other words, if he had said to her, this does destroy your estate planning because of all the tax consequences, so I really can't leave a third to each child, and she says it's more important to me to have mineral rights, I want you to write that way, then the beneficiaries have no standing to argue.
They would have no claim.
So the conflict is to me, is not really the children and their expectations, it was the client fully advised, so the client made a fully informed choice, and if the attorney followed the fully informed choice, then there should be no issue of negligence.
My very note, Your Honor, on this point is that we have developed the concept of informed consent in medicine. We have developed the concept of full disclosure of the terms and conditions of insurance policies relative to insurance agents. This is nothing more than that. The attorney has an obligation to fulfill his client's desire after he has placed the client in possession of the necessary facts and circumstances that affect that client's decision. That did not happen here. But that admittedly did not happen here because Attorney Gindelsberger, in his own deposition, admits that he never knew of the effect
counsel,
of Section 23.
Following up on Justice Stratton's question, the question becomes, and I think she singles out,
I'm sorry.
I think she correctly singles out the issue. I mean, it very well could be that this woman wanted to do exactly what she did, and if taxes drained the rest of her estate, then there wasn't anything to give out, and maybe that's what she intended. But the question becomes, if we modify the rule requiring privity, to whom who should have the right to maintain an action and who should not? The amicus suggests if people are named in the will, they should be in the class of folks that could maintain an action. If they're not named in the will, tough luck. Is that where you would draw the line?
No, Your Honor, I would not. I would draw the line as set forth in our proposition of law, that lawyers who are negligent I'm sorry, that an intended beneficiary of a decedent's estate plan, which beneficiary is known
so
to be.
So does that include every next of kin?
I'm sorry?
Would that include every next of kin?
Only if that was the client's desire. When the client makes his or her wishes known to the estate planning attorney, that estate planning attorney has an obligation, we believe, to, in a workmanlike fashion.
Okay, so how do you establish that? You file a lawsuit not knowing and then depose the attorney? Because the client's gone.
In this particular case, and I would think in most cases where this would be an issue, there is and would be a clear paper trail as to what was wished by the client, what the client wanted, what communications the client had.
And how does your intended beneficiary get a hold of that paper trail?
Well, I would think, Your Honor, that under the worst of circumstances, it would be in the discovery process in a lawsuit. If the facts discovered did not show that the discoverer, the complainant, the plaintiff, was within this protected class.
But isn't that the problem with drawing the circle as large as you would want to? And it isn't the amicus suggestion that if you're named in the will, you could bring the action, but if not, you can't.
I believe.
I mean, because what you're suggesting is you shoot for the moon with no facts to back it up, and isn't that what the legal profession gets hammered for all the time? And while I'm commenting, I think the problem with your specific, I'm attracted to what you're asking for. The problem with your specific lawsuit is it seems to imply that every lawyer who represents a client and drafts a will or prepares a deed somehow has to explore all the client's assets and explain all the possible tax ramifications of what they're doing, or they're guilty of malpractice.
And that seems to invite
a standard that's way too high.
Your Honor, that would be true only in the circumstance where the attorney who commits the malpractice was indeed in the practice of estate planning for that client. If Mrs. Jones were to walk into my office on a given day and say, I want to hire you to do one thing, draw a will or draw a deed or a power of appointment in a trust, and I did that, and that was all I was required to do, that's the only thing I was asked to do, I had no other knowledge, then of course I believe that I would not be responsible for the unknown or for the unforeseeable to me consequences of that act. But where the attorney is the estate planning attorney, is the business attorney, where the attorney has been trusted by the client to do an estate plan that effectuates my desires, you know my assets, you know what I have, you know my children are the ones I wish to benefit, and that attorney then, in a haphazard fashion, says, okay, today's job is to do a deed. Tomorrow's job is to do a codicil.
Counsel,
you can't do that in a vacuum.
Was there testimony that her paramount desire was to avoid estate taxes?
That there was never testimony to that effect. The only testimony, and it was testimony by Attorney Gindelsberger, was that her paramount desire was to benefit her three children at all times in equipoise.
Okay, so if there's no testimony that there's a desire to, at all costs, avoid estate taxes, the property could be divvied up. It's just that they all had to come up with the tax money.
Absolutely, and that would have remedied the problem. We wouldn't be here today if Mr. Gindelsberger had said, okay, we're going to do this, but we have to have a different clause in your will that I drafted and republished and redrafted, which is a tax apportionment clause, because that way these taxes will be apportioned, rather than the will that I drafted, which says the entire taxes due from the estate are paid from the residuary of the estate.
Counsel, it's easy to be distracted to your specific case from the larger legal principle. the intuitive problem I have with your specific case is the Hanna farm must have been worth a lot, and she chose to give it to a son, presumably for reasons that related to the son's connection to the farm and what he was doing for mom or whatever. And the rest of her estate couldn't have been that large. Taxes wouldn't have consumed it. The Hanna farm must have been worth a lot, and the rest of the estate must not have been very large.
In fact, at the time of the gift, the Hanna farm was worth about one-third of her estate. Because of the operation of 2036, which is the retained interest rule, at the death of the testator some 20 years later, that farm had increased in value twofold. Had it not been for that, there would have been no taxable estate. If the Hanna farm had been evaluated at its value on the date of gift, which it could have been, and her estate got the credit for the credit under the estate and gift tax provisions of the Internal Revenue Code, there would have been no tax. But because over the course of time between 1990 and 2003, that farm had greatly appreciated in value, and it was that new total value that was included in the estate, we now have a far different situation. And that is one of the reasons that the damages are as high in this case as they are.
Mr. Rosenfield, let me ask you a legal question. I participated in Simon, obviously it was in the majority, but I'm willing to reconsider, frankly, because I think when I look at all the other professions upon whom we've placed the burden of foreseeability to third parties, it seems to me that we really do need to look at our own profession. The problem I have is the restatement governing lawyers, as you know, is decided. U.S. or the Supreme Court of New Jersey used it, and the other cite to a test I thought was pretty good. Both refer to errors that were made in, it seems to me, errors that were made in the drafting of the will rather than the lawyer's lack of knowledge of the law. How do we fit those if we want to? How do we fit?
Because, Your Honor, I think what we now have here in Ohio and in the country is not merely the exercise of drafting a simple will. That was the case at one time. Now, everything that we do as estate planning lawyers is somehow related and interconnected to everything else that we do as estate planning lawyers. The early cases that came up because of errors in either the execution or the drafting of a will. None of those cases factually had the fact pattern that we have before us today. However, everything we do today, if we are in this business of wealth planning, of estate planning, of succession planning, everything we do is interrelated. As wealth planning lawyers or as estate planning lawyers, it is not atypical for the lawyer to be concerned with business succession plans, with insurance policies, with wills, with trusts, with deeds, with transfers of property, both inter vivos and testamentary. None of the other cases considered those particular aspects. I think that your concern is a genuine concern because of the other cases thus far have only considered one aspect of that. This case gives this court the opportunity to consider the way law is practiced today in Ohio and in this country and the way the estate planning industry has developed.
It needs
to be controlled.
I'm not going to compete with you. I don't have a voice. In some ways, this case is really simpler than those cases, it seems to me, because there was an admitted negligent act by the lawyer. And we don't know whether that information the lawyer should have given the client would have changed her mind, but it certainly seems as if there's reason to believe it may have because of her declared intention to pass along her property to her children. So it may be this is an easier case and a very narrow case where the negligence is so obvious. We don't have competing beneficiaries claiming that, you know, she didn't draft the will the way she was supposed to for me. None of that's here. It's a clear clear negligence, and there's a very obvious result from that negligence. We've used your time, so thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Nemeth.
Chief Justice Moyer, Justices of the Ohio Supreme Court, Counsel, and ladies and gentlemen. Your Honor, you correctly point out that this case is one where a societal interest is to ensure that lawyers provide competent legal services and that courts provide adequate remedies for malpractice in those situations. Justice Moore, I would like to just address the point that you just made recently, because I think it needs to be delved into. In this particular case, these facts that you have before you in this matter are not the appropriate facts that you want to use if you want to revisit the issue of privity. In this particular case, a warranty deed or survivorship deed was done at the specific request of the client in the summer of 1990, I believe it was, when Mrs. Schlegel went to the appellee's office. She didn't ask for tax advice. She specifically wanted only one thing done, and that was to have a survivorship deed drafted giving her one son, Roy, who elected to remain on the dairy farm, this particular Hannah Dairy Farm, because that was the one that was most productive. All the other family members were well aware of the fact that he was going to get it by way of the deed, excuse me, by way of a will. And in the discussions that my client had with Mrs. Schlegel, he specifically said, why do you want to retain a life interest? It was Mrs. Schlegel who insisted on retaining a life interest because she wanted the right to control any potential chance that Roy, her son, might want to transfer that property out of their family farm. She did not come to the appellee for tax advice. Tax was not even a consideration. Her most compelling and driving requirement was she wanted to retain a life interest so she could control the property and it not be disposed of.
But if we find that there would be an action here by the plaintiff against the lawyer, just say we recognize it could be an act. That's all facts, and I mean that would be determined by a trial court. Our issue is whether a lawyer in this situation has immunity from being sued because a beneficiary of his client is unhappy.
Well, and I would suggest, Your Honor, if we have that question, the addressing of it by this court is not going to make it go away. It's going to become far more complicated for lawyers who have a compelling, undivided interest to their client. There are numerous lawyers and wills that have been drafted over the years where the lawyers only considered the interest of their client, the testator, as paramount. And there weren't any other considerations given. They never considered what impact it might have on the beneficiaries.
But wouldn't there be a factual issue here whether the documents that the lawyer prepared met the intention of the decedent now?
First of all, that's a good question, and there is no factual question for this reason. When she was in his office, and no one contradicts this or takes issue with it, he specifically told her, have you considered the tax consequences? Because she never brought it up. And he said, I think you need to have this reviewed by a tax man. I don't do taxes. I don't know the tax complications that are involved. You need to take this to your CPA. He specifically remembered talking to her about a gentleman whose name is Ken Bowman, who does all of her taxes. And she indeed did just that. So she received advice that he couldn't give from a CPA as to the tax consequences of either retaining this in her estate or gifting it out immediately. So if we say, well, he should have done more, it's in the context of a warranty deed, and a client has a right to have some control over how the property is going to be distributed in their lifetime. You know, counsel mentions again and again and again the intent as described in the decedent's will. That was the will that she drafted in 1986. We're talking about unequivocal, clear intent in 1990, 4 years later, when she shows up at the attorney's office and says, I know I'm giving it to him in my will. I know that. But he and I have talked, and he wants it now, and I don't think there's a problem with my giving it to him now, and I want to give it to him now.
Counsel, the opposing counsel stated that when this will was drafted, the property represented a third of her assets, and 13 years later, I mean, after the, well, longer than 13 years, but after the transfer by warranty deed, it had appreciated, you know, et cetera. It seems to me that we're also maybe extending the duty of the attorney to follow up and say, gee, what I did for you in 1986 and 1990 is going to be affected by the value of your property, and farm properties rising in value, maybe we ought to take another look at that.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor.
Which is an impossible task for any attorney to have to
monitor. It is. And beyond that, there are a lot of clients who don't want that type of attention because they're going to be billed for some lawyer reviewing their estate plan yearly or every 2 or 3 years, and they may not want that. They want to limit what's done by an attorney. And she wanted to limit it to the drafting of this survivorship will. She had already gone through it. I might add that in this particular case, the attorney suggested, and I think they did do, an appraisal of the farm properties. So with the appraisal and with the impact of a CPA involved in the case, she had as much knowledge then about what the value was. Property has consistently gone up, but realistically in the last year, we've seen property values go down. So no one really knows where the future directions lie.
You essentially, if we were to change the law and allow some limited accountability for attorneys for estate planning malpractice, you're contending you'd still win on the facts under this case.
Well, I believe so, but I'll let you finish your question, Justice Stratton.
That was,
I'm sorry.
The end of my question.
I believe I would, but more importantly, I think it's damaging precedent in our legal community because what's going to happen is another lawyer doing the same kind of work. Sure, he could video the estate plan. He could spend countless times with more people, but once he's sued, he may have a chilling effect as to whether or not he wants to do that type of work again. Mm-hmm. We are basically saying that there is a responsibility you have to people who are not even vested beneficiaries yet.
Well, let's take a different scenario then to address that. You're hired to draft a will. Your client wants it to leave to her daughter, Mary. And you mistakenly type in her daughter, Martha.
Okay.
Unequivocal. Currently, there is no recourse under Ohio law, correct?
Yes.
And even the administrator of an estate doesn't stand in, I mean, the decedent can't sue, they're dead. The estate administrator can't sue, no standing for an administrator of estate, executive of estate to sue. Clear malpractice, clear mistake, but no recourse under current law.
There may not be, Your Honor. I can't think of an exception off the top of my head, but there may very well be. But let me just add that I'm glad you asked that question, because if you remember at the beginning of my discussion, I mentioned I don't think the facts in this case are the ones that this court wants to have to use to address the privity issue for your very reason. All of the cases, if not all of them, the vast majority of them, that are cited in the Zipperstein opinion and in subsequent opinions showing a trend by other jurisdictions to move away from the privity requirement, all of those cases generally focus on a mistake in drafting or a mistake or negligence in the document preparation or in the essence of what the lawyer was doing for the client that gave rise to damages. In this particular case, nothing that my client did, the appellee did in this case in the drafting, caused any problems. And you are correct. If there was a mistake in the name, if there was a signature line left off, if there was an incorrect description of the deed, if it wasn't filed on time, any of those factors would be different, and that would make
sense.
So
you're saying maybe at some point we should address expanding responsibility and liability on attorneys, but bad facts make bad law, and you're arguing this is bad facts.
Exactly. And I might add to that, that doesn't mean I'm necessarily in favor of the elimination of privity in attorney matters. Because I think the canons of professional responsibility give us an enormous hurdle, and mm-hmm. The court's already brought that up. And I just don't know how you're going to get around that, in addition to the duty to going back.
Other states have done it, though, have they not?
They have.
Many have. And we're in the minority.
There seems to be a trend in that
problem.
Mr. Nemeth, in your understanding of the cases that have been cited, are there any cases that would go this far and talk about the extension to beneficiaries so that it almost seems that any non-client who is arguably harmed could sue the attorney? Are there any that go that far?
Exactly. I have not seen any. I think that's a real stretch. And I think beyond that, as you go further out and further out, you have more and more complications. The nice thing about the court in Zipperstein, and then even in Elam, what we had was a limitation that made sense and it served that purpose at that time. But Zipperstein dealt with the underlining matter. In this particular case, there is nothing wrong with the warranty deed that he did.
So, counsel, there's a distinction to be made from pure malpractice based on the outcome as opposed to an errors and omission type of activity on the part of the lawyer.
That may,
and the
yes.
drafting of a will incorrectly, misnaming an heir, leaving out a signature line, having one witness instead of two, et cetera, that's kind of an error and omission type of negligence or and the consequential, this tax ramifications and then those ramifications on the potential beneficiaries and the establishment of, you know, equity and taxes and everything, that's a whole different complicated ball of wax.
That's exactly right, and really this case underscores it because in this particular case, if you were to consider the competing and compelling interests of the beneficiaries, you have one son, Roy, who's getting the farm, but he doesn't want to pay any taxes. You have the other two that would say, well, if mom kept it in her estate, you know, the taxes would, you know, would be paid at that time, but he was certainly going to have to pay his fair share. And at some point, the compelling interest of the testator, in this case, the person who wanted to grant the gift, because it's really not the testating document that creates the problem, it's this limited warranty deed, the party that drafts that has these competing interests, and he's going to compromise it because he's going to say, I know you want to retain a life interest, let me talk you out of the life interest and why it's not a good idea, because if you do a life interest, you create problems for me. And it would just be so much easier if you would do an outright gift or if you would just keep it in your estate.
Why shouldn't she know that? I mean, that's lawyers advise their clients every day, and the client makes the choice. He didn't advise her what the law is. And so she signed a will not knowing. Now, you could say the accountant, she should have talked to the accountant about that. That's facts. I guess the question is whether the lawyer's failure to advise her of the law, which had a foreseeable impact on beneficiaries, whether that's actionable. Okay.
Justice Moyer, they are confusing you a little bit because they are not complaining about anything that was done in the drafting of the will or in any way or form she should have been given advice during the drafting of the will in 1986.
I heard your opposing counsel say just that.
Well,
that she should have been given the information. She may have drafted the, she may have signed the same will. She may have changed it, but she didn't have the information from the lawyer.
There was no event in 1986.
I think he was talking about the tax apportionment responsibilities rather than having the estate be responsible for the taxes.
Yeah.
That if the one son was getting the Hanna farm and the others were getting the other, a tax apportionment should have been included.
You could have, you might not have, but at that point in 1986, there was no discussion about gifting the Hanna farm 4 years later out to the son, Roy, to keep. He was the one that stayed on the dairy farm. These folks had maintained this dairy farm their whole life. They paid off the mortgage, and Mrs. Schlegel would consistently said she does not want this farm mortgaged. And the most overriding consideration, and I think it's getting lost in our conversation, the most overriding consideration is she wanted a life estate retained, and she wanted to keep it, and that was the only thing that was driving her. And when counsel told her to get independent tax advice and told her that she already had a gentleman that she frequently used for tax matters, and he's in the same town, and she sees that person, I don't know how much more the lawyer does.
Counsel?
Yes.
I would like to focus on if we decide to use this case to move off of the limitations requiring privity. I assume you would agree with the amicus that it ought to stop with folks who are named in the will in terms of who could bring a cause of action? That's my first question.
Well, first of all, I not that I wouldn't. It's just I think that's a far reach. I really don't. In fact, if you want to look at the amicus, look at the brief of the amicus that was filed in the Leroy case that you had before you last year. And that amicus by the Ohio State Bar Association talked about how it makes no sense to extend privity and all the humongous complications it causes.
But if we decided to, would you agree that it should stop with those who are actually named in the will rather than including next of kin who are not named in the will?
I'll tell you why I think that's a bad idea, and it's just my thoughts here legally. I think it's a bad idea because it is taking property that a person mentions in their estate plan years and years and years earlier as having somehow been frozen in time, and we want people to feel that they have the right to go ahead and transfer property, sell property, do anything they want to with property.
Counsel, I think we understand that Mr. Rosenfield is probably asking for too much with his lawsuit as it pertains to your, because A, as you point out, when she made her will, the farm is discussed in the will, and the event that he's really complaining about is the deed and not the making of the will. So
yes,
that even if we were to extend this issue, it becomes problematic as to your case. And we also understand that people do insurance, they do payable on death accounts, they do all kinds of things that the lawyer may not even be aware of, or they do it after they leave the lawyer's office that can affect that. It seems that this case, the underpinnings of this case, is asking the lawyer to be clairvoyant and to have the client in every 6 months and reexamine the assets and all of that. Well, that would be a nice piece of business for a whole lot of lawyers, but that's a little much. But on the other hand, as the chief points out, there is most states have moved off of where we are, and they have at least moved to the restatement position. That probably doesn't mean that your client loses if we were to do that based on the facts that you've articulated, does it?
I don't think it does, but I do think it is somewhat problematic for all of us as practicing lawyers, because we would have perhaps a decision that, as you hypothetically point out, might change the law and make further inroads into privity. But on the other hand, there are so many lawyers that have already drafted documents, and be they deeds or wills or whatever, and part of the estate plan, and focused exclusively on the interests and the rights and the desires of the testator. Mm-hmm. And that creates an enormous problem for the whole gap of people out there.
What was the tax, the total tax? What was the size of the estate?
You know what, I have to tell you, I honestly don't know. I know it
she
was
died when?
In, I believe, late 1990s.
She died in 2003, Your
Honor. Okay.
So there's a pretty good federal exemption at that point. So
yes.
The estate couldn't have been very large.
No, I don't believe
what was left.
Right, exactly.
Thank you, Mr. Nemeth.
Sure.
Mr. Rosenfield, you used a lot of time. Take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think it's important to remember that although the will was executed, the original will in 1986, and this real estate transaction took place in 1990, there was a codicil to the will in 1994, there was a review of the will in 1996, and a review of the will in 1997. Mr. Gintelsberger had many, many, many opportunities.
Okay, so what, after he's prepared the deed at her instruction,
correct, Your Honor.
What can he do with the codicils and all of the rest that are going to take care of the
assuming that he had understood
the two children that end up with an empty sack?
Yeah, assuming that he had understood the law, he could have simply advised Mrs. Schlegel to change her will to include a tax apportionment clause. He could have advised her to complete the gift by removing her reservations of rights and to make the gift on the basis of a net
gift. Okay, so what does it, how does a tax apportionment clause
because what a tax apportionment clause would say would be the property that son ended up with, he's responsible for the taxes on that. The property the daughter ends up with, she's responsible for the taxes on that. The property the other
and you
son.
You can do that in a will. You can make him pay money into the estate to pay the estate taxes?
No, Your Honor, you can't make him pay money into the estate, but you can make him primarily liable under the terms of the will to do that. You make what is known as a net gift.
The horse is out of the barn after the deed is made. I don't see how fiddling around with wills after that is going to solve the problem that you're complaining about.
With all respect, I believe, Your Honor, that by a modification of the will to include a tax apportionment clause so as to take the taxes out, the responsibility for taxes, out of the residue of the estate, out of the remainder of the estate, and place it at the top of the estate would do exactly that. In addition to that, if I may.
You need to sum up.
Well, counsel, before you sum up, I have a question about the responsibility for the defense of this. If the law is changed by this court, every attorney is responsible for having malpractice insurance.
Correct.
It's mandatory. When an attorney purchases and discloses to their carrier the type of work they do and everything, there's a certain amount that they pay for that coverage. If we change the law now and we go back or you know, there's wills out there and estates in progress, et cetera, for which you're advocating the malpractice carrier be responsible for the defense and maybe ultimately a payout here, that premiums have not even been paid upon.
Your Honor, as a practical matter, that argument, I believe, is incorrect. All of us have insurance on what's known as a claim-made basis. Therefore, if I am insured today and the cause of action arises today, the policy that I have currently is responsible for that. If indeed the insurance industry believed that this would cause irreparable damage to its asset base, I will guarantee you that in the next go-round, they will charge more money to their estate planning clientele. The issue here is simply...
You've used your time, Mr. Rosenfield.
I'm sorry?
You've used your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
The case is submitted. You will be advised of our opinion.